You are listening to Trick to You with Jono and G'day. Wherever you may be around the world, it is good to have your company. It is time for Light of the Prophets with Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, Yoel.
Now, by the way, you don't have to yell. We can hear without yelling.
No, I'm excited. What are you talking about? I'm excited. I've had a cup of coffee. I've had a little block of chocolate, and I'm raring to go into Chapter 6. That's where we're up to, well, right?
You have to spend more time with me. It'll make you a bit more mellow.
Chapter 6 of Joshua is where we're up to, and it's, come on, I mean, this is a pretty exciting chapter. I mean, you can't do this one mellow. All right, this is how it begins, really.
No, I can read chapters about
there war.
There
is no
stuff
way I'm letting you do this one mellow.
I've fallen asleep in
the middle of watching. We're not doing Chapter 6 mellow. We're not going to fall asleep. I'm too excited. Don't bring it down. Here it goes. It begins like this. Now, Jericho was securely shut. It was shut up because of the children of Israel. They looked out there and they went, oh, we're in trouble. And none went out and none came in. And Yehovah said to Joshua, see, I have given Jericho into your hand, the king and then the mighty men of valor. You shall march around the city. All you men of war, you shall go around the city once, and this you shall do 6 days. And 7 priests shall bear 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. But the 7th day, there's a lot of sevens in here, you shall march around the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. And it shall come to pass that when you make the long blast of the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, that all the people shall shout a great shout, and then the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people shall go up every man straight before him. So, first of all, Yoel, what is the significance of 7 in the Jewish world?
Ooh, 7.
There's a lot of 7s here. There's a repetition of 7s throughout this chapter 6. It should have been chapter 7.
So, the thing is that 7 is important to everywhere around the world. I mean, at least in the ancient Mesopotamian world, 7 was a very, very important number. It was usually 3, 7, and 9 or something like that. There were several numbers which were very, very important. Mm-hmm. And 7 is a mystical number. It represents some kind of something with power. You know, it's just a number. I mean, we don't really fully understand. I mean, from what I've read up to now, we don't fully understand the usage of the number 7. It's just a mystical number that represents a lot of power. Yeah. And is used repetitively in the Bible in many, many places. It also sometimes represents something which is an absolute, you know.
Something of completion?
It says in one place, Sheva yipol tzadik vakam. 7 times a righteous person will fall and he'll get up. The 7 doesn't represent, okay, fall 7 times. It represents an absolute, meaning all the time. The righteous person can fall all the time, but he'll always get up. Mm-hmm. So the seven here represents as if they're taking something like either represents the entire people of Israel or it represents absolute power. Uh-huh. But it's very obvious that there's also a psychological thing here that when they peek out from the walls and they see 7 priests walking with the ark with trumpets, because priests were, it's obvious it's a priest, they were wearing white robes. Mm-hmm. This was all done and with all the rules of ceremony, meaning if they have to work as they're actually working now as if they're working in the tabernacle. So my opinion is they probably wore the priestly garments. So it was obvious these were priests. Mm-hmm. And they were holding trumpets in their hands. Well, it wasn't trumpets, it was shofarot. So it was the yovel, which is a ram's horn. Mm-hmm. It's called a yovel because it's movil. I saw a commentary about that. It's called a yovel because it was the movil, which is what that leads the herd. So they kind of played a game with its purpose and the ram's purpose in the herd. And then what the horn is, it's also long or something. Bit of a game there. Mm-hmm. And they probably picked out, and they see 7 priests with an ark. And these people are certain that they realize something pretty serious is going on here. It's not. This is a religious war. They're not just attacking us. So they're doing something very symbolic here. Mm-hmm. And it, by the way, it's the only city that it was done to. And we have to understand Jericho is extremely symbolic. It was considered to be the key to the land. If you want, the sages teach that anyone who holds Jericho is the one who holds the key to the land. And this is where what was done to Jericho was also very, very important. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot. The symbolism here is because also Jericho was very symbolic as well as its function as a city. As I mentioned last time, you know, it sits on the center of a route that led to Arabia and Egypt as well. So
strategically, a very important city. And as we read last week as well, Rahab pointed out, and she says in Joshua chapter 2 verse 8, she goes on to say, I know that Yehovah has given you the land, and that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you, for we have heard how Yehovah has done this, he's done that, he's so great. And so they're obviously, they've shut up the city, and they're freaking out because every day they keep, the Israelites are marching around there, but they're not doing anything. They're just marching, and at the end of the march, they blow their shofar, and what does it mean? And we're scared, and what's that box that they're carrying?
Also a lot of, it's a lot of psychological warfare going on as well.
Yeah.
The dramatic crossing of the Jordan. You know, remember we pointed out that there was a repeat of the language in the book of Exodus in the Song on the Sea. There's a lot of basically they're scaring them to death.
Mm.
And by the way, it says here that it's Yericho sogeret u'mesugaret. Says it's not just shut down. There's a double locking here where no one goes in, no one goes out, no one's doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sitting there in the city, scared out of their minds. Now. Let me explain something about Jericho itself. I mean, last week we didn't really describe this, but Jericho was excavated about 3 times. And if you look at the schematics of Jericho, it was a pretty serious city. It wasn't one of these little towns. The wall there was complex.
Mm-hmm.
The thickness was very serious. This was a fortress. It wasn't just a city, a walled city. This was a fortress.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a few very important things you have to understand about the city of Jericho. First of all, it is a key in understanding the chronology of the Exodus, because the way you measure it, the way you give a chronology for a place and you decide what layer belongs to what is based on different pottery, mm-hmm, and things like, mm-hmm, that. And first of all, one of the big mistakes were done by the city of Jericho is that there was one lady who's probably one of the most important archaeologists ever to excavate the land of Israel, mm-hmm, called Catherine Kenyon, who made a few assumptions. And some of the assumptions were really silly. I mean, I actually listened to an interview with a man who actually worked with her back in the 50s. She excavated from 1952 to 1956, or 1953, 1956. That was the third and last excavation. And she concluded a few things. First of all, one of the things that the complaint was that she worked on based on what she does not find in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how she decided what happened when. And then she, based on that, she said, oh, when Joshua crossed the river, there was no Jericho. And it was destroyed hundreds of years before, about 150 years before he crossed the river. Now, it's pretty amazing, as I point out all the time, archaeologists make assumptions,
mm-hmm,
and if they're important, it becomes the truth, even if there's a lot of holes in it. And I actually posted a video a while back on my Hebrew in Israel. It talks about the city of Jericho, and they explain some of the mistakes there. And, you know, it's a religious video, so maybe there's a few mistakes that they made themselves, but I keep on always looking at this, that if you find something, the Bible describes something else, there has to be a correlation here, because if the Bible says, okay, Jericho was destroyed, burnt to the ground, the wall tumbled upon itself and everything, mm-hmm, and we find that, you know, it can't be, and the only the Israelites are the ones who claim that this happened with them, it has to be that it's true. We just have to relook the chronology, and chronology is a pretty problematic thing. One of the problematic things with chronology is a lot of it's based on the Egyptian chronology, that has a lot of problems with it. Because pharaohs had double names, sometimes up to 5 names, and sometimes documents would have one name, the document would have another name, and they think these are completely different dynasties. There are 30 dynasties in Egypt, and probably were there only something like 20, mm-hmm, 21, and that's 22 maybe. That's one of the really important things. It's very, very important to understand. So Jericho is actually a very important key in understanding the chronology of the land of Israel.
From an archaeological standpoint, it's very, very important. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think there's another thing here, and this is my speculation, but I think God deliberately did it this way, so thousands of years later we come and we find it, and we know, okay, it's here. It's actually happened.
Uh-huh. Sure.
It's very, very important. I love these. The Bible goes into certain descriptions deliberately. One of them to show the glory of God and what he did, but also I think there's a lot of historical, God basically says, okay, 1,000 years from now, 2,000 years, 3,000 years from now, I want to do it this way, so my children, when they come back and they see, they find what really happened, then there'll be evidence on this.
Yep, excellent. No, that makes perfect sense. And verse 15, but it came to pass on the seventh day, and of course they did this for 6 days, but on the seventh day that they rose early about the dawning of the day and marched around the city 7 times in the same manner. On that day, only. They marched around the city seven times, and the seventh time it happened, when the priest blew the trumpets, and Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for Yehovah has given you the city. Now the city shall be doomed by Yehovah to destruction, it and all who are in it. Only Rahab," and this is obviously honoring the covenant that was made with Rahab, "only Rahab, the harlot, shall live, she and all who are with her in the house, because she hid the messengers that we sent. And you by all means," now this is important, and I want to ask you about this, is verse 18. "And you by all means," he says to them, "abstain from the accursed things, lest you become accursed when you take of the accursed things and make the camp of Israel a curse and trouble it." And that reminds me, obviously, it says in the Torah, Deuteronomy 7, verse 26, and I'll just whip over there quickly. It says pretty much word for word, "Nor shall you bring an abomination into your house, lest you be doomed to destruction like it. You shall utterly detest it and utterly abhor it, for it is an accursed thing." And just before that, it's talking about the carved images, their gods, you shall burn with fire. "You shall not covet the silver or gold that is on them, or take it for yourselves, lest you be snared by it, for it is an abomination to Yehovah. Nor shall you bring the abomination into your house, lest you be doomed," and so on and so forth. Now, in this case here, in verse 18, it says pretty much the same thing, but it goes on to say, "But all the silver and gold and the vessels of bronze and iron, they are consecrated to Yehovah. They shall come into the treasury of Yehovah." So, are we talking about here, when he's talking about accursed things, are we talking specifically, do you think, about idols, idols of false gods, things like that?
No. Literally, no. This whole act here is very symbolic. The declaration was that the entire city is to be destroyed. Everything is to be destroyed. And anything that you can use will be taken and consecrated to the God of Israel. Right. We actually have several examples of this. If, for example, you look at Leviticus, first of all, what you pointed out is very important. The languages are also, again, similar to the book of Deuteronomy that we mentioned last time.
Mm-hmm.
But, for example, if you go to the end of the book of Leviticus, it mentions there, actually some of the last verses in it, let me open it up just very quickly, and it says a story. It doesn't tell a story. It starts going over a whole list of things, and it says, it's chapter 27, verse 29. It says, anything which is consecrated to God, it says cherem, and it uses the same word, cherem. So something which is a cherem, and the word cherem today, modern Hebrew, is not used the same way, but the word cherem basically means something which is forbidden, okay? And it becomes, but it's not forbidden as if, you know, like a forbidden fruit. It's forbidden, and in this case, forbidden to for usage for people, but it can be used for God. So what it says here, that anything which is a cherem to God, it will not be redeemed, but will die. So we're talking about here, for example, if we decide to proclaim a cherem on a city, then it goes in and we go in and we destroy it completely. And we actually have an example like that in the book of Numbers, where they went out to war and they actually lost the war. They went out for a battle against a certain group of people. I'm actually trying to find it because I don't remember exactly where it is. But they go out to war and they actually lose. So they take an oath and they say, if you give us this city, we will make it a cherem. They go in and they completely destroy the city.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Okay.
I'm actually looking for that word because for that section. It's a bit.
So while you're looking for that, so if I'm to understand you correctly, I think what you're saying is that the entire city was declared to be destroyed. Therefore, the entire city and everything that was in it was accursed. Only the silver, the gold, the bronze, and the iron was to come into the treasuries of Yehovah, but everything else was to be destroyed. Right?
Exactly.
Therefore, they're not supposed to touch. They're not supposed to touch.
And they were not supposed to touch anything.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Numbers. So the passage is Numbers 21, verses 1 to 3. "And the king of Arad, the Canaanite, who dwelt in the south, heard that Israel was coming on the road to Atharim." Is that right?
The Atharim. We're not too sure exactly what they are.
"Then he fought against Israel and took some of them as prisoners." So not only did he, I mean, he took some of them. Okay, so Israel made a vow to Yehovah and said, "If you will indeed deliver this people into my hand, then I will utterly destroy their cities." And Yehovah listened to the voice of Israel and delivered up the Canaanites, and they utterly destroyed them and their cities. So the name of that place was called Hormah.
Chorma. So it's a game, the word is Cherem, and they call it Chorma as an actual name.
Okay.
So that's actually very common. We have the same situation with games of names later on when we start talking about what happened after they conquered the city. Now, it actually says here that they got to the war, they yell out, you know, whatever they yelled out, maybe just made a noise.
Mm-hmm.
It actually says the city, it says that the wall fell upon itself.
Do you know, that's interesting, because I've got something different. The wall fell upon itself, that suggests to me that it crumbled upon itself. But what I have in the English is that the wall fell down flat. And I imagine the wall just coming apart from one side and falling down, literally falling down flat as, you know, like one piece of one whole wall just starting to lean and then falling down as one piece. But in the Hebrew, you're telling me that it crumbles upon itself.
Yeah, it says, "V'tipol ha'choma tachtia," the wall fell upon itself. So here's a very interesting thing. When they excavated Jericho,
mm-hmm.
there was like this earth thing on the bottom, which was like a base for the wall, and there was a brick wall. And so basically, the wall fell outside, and the top part fell up on the bottom part, mm-hmm. creating a ramp. So what he tells them is when the wall falls over, each person will go up where he is.
And
so the whole description, it fits what happened. The wall crumbled, the wall fell outwards upon itself because one part fell on the other part. Okay, so it did fell upon itself.
Yeah.
And then each person went up from where they're standing. So they actually had a ramp in front of them. So think of it as if you take an orange and you half peel it and you fold it out.
Yes.
And it's the peel is still there, but it's falling out as if it's a ramp. And all you have to do is just climb up, you know?
And so, that's interesting because reading it in the English, I didn't get that picture, but clearly in the Hebrew it's there. And so the wall falls down upon itself in a way that makes a ramp. And then it goes on to say, as you said, then the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they took the city and they utterly destroyed all that was in the city. Now, this doesn't fly very well in the tradition that I came from, Yoel. When we read things like this where it says, they went up into the city, both man and woman and young and old, and ox and sheep and donkey, they all killed with the edge of the sword. So everyone was slain, babies, women, elderly.
He said, you're one saying the edge of the sword, and it says the picharev, and the picharev, it's very, very interesting. There's a little game here. They treat it as if the sword eats. So it's the edge of the sword, yes, but it actually can be translated as the mouth of the sword.
Really?
And there's a place where it actually says, Kach tochal hacharev. This is how the sword eats. So this is why we call it a pi cherev. A pi, can, in this case, will be the edge of something as well sometimes.
Uh-huh.
But here in this case, there's like a double meaning here. The edge of it and also what it eats, the mouth of it.
Wow. So the edge of the sword. Okay, so the sword is literally eating, if you like, and destroying men, women, young, and old.
Yes, that is a bit disturbing for a lot of people today. But the Torah did say that when you enter the land, no covenants, nothing. The nations who sit in the land, you have to destroy them. And it's also a punishment because, if, for example, it says in another place, Kilo shalem avonai mori. The sin of the Amorites is not fulfilled yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's not full yet.
True.
So this is not just conquering the land. This is God also punishing, which goes into a whole thing that I've been talking about lately. I'm going to actually look up the verse exactly where it is, because it's also very, very important. This is in Genesis 15 verses 13 to 16. Mm-hmm. And it actually says that, you know, when God promises the land to Abraham, he says to him, there will be in a land, foreign land, there will be captives there, and then the fourth generation will return here, fulfillment of it. And he says to him, why is it so? He says, Ki lo shalem avonai mori ad hena. The sin of the Amorites is not complete yet that I have to go and punish them.
Mm-hmm.
He's waiting to punish them, so he also put the Israelites on hold for four generations.
Mm-hmm.
And, so also what's going on here is their job is to punish the Amorites.
Sure.
It goes in the whole issue of God basically does get involved in the rest of the world. He's not just the God of Israel, he's also the God of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And he cares about every human being in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why he would punish, for example, if someone commits an atrocity and he's not an Israelite, it doesn't mean God's, you're not one of my people, I'm ignoring you. No, God says, payback time.
Mm.
And he does it. He does it. End of story.
If they're in trouble, they're in trouble, and the Israelites are doing what they're told. And in doing so, of course, as I mentioned, they saved Rahab and her father's house, her mother and her brothers and all that she had, and they brought out all her relatives and left them outside the camp of Israel. So, but everything else was destroyed. And it's interesting because in verse 25, Joshua spared Rahab the harlot, her father's household, and all that she had. So she dwells in Israel to this day because she hid the messengers whom Joshua went to spy out Jericho.
By the way, there's a Jewish tradition that Joshua married Rahab.
Really?
There's a few interesting traditions about this, that he married Rahab, and this war happened on a Sabbath.
Interesting. Now, I was going to ask you about that. I was going to ask you about that because there is obviously the significance of seven is highly represented in Shabbat. And we see that they march around 7 days and then take it on the they march around 6 days and then do it again on the seven, march around seven times and take it and so on and so forth. So obviously one of those days is the Shabbat. So what are your thoughts in regards to that?
So it doesn't say Yom HaShabbat. It says Hayom HaShavi'i. So it's the seventh day from the beginning when they started it. So Sabbath was probably somewhere inside those days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but there's an entry in the Tractate of Shabbat that says that the name of Shammai the Elder, that they conquered Jericho on the Sabbath. So,
possible.
Maybe. You know, and I think it mostly comes because there was an argument at the time. Basically, if you know the story of what happened with the Hasmoneans, the Jews wouldn't fight on the Sabbath.
Uh-huh.
And then they stood up and said, well, we're dying here. What's the point? So they went out to war.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be that that's when they decided that, okay, Jericho was conquered on the Sabbath.
Mm-hmm. No.
Just try to find some kind of a entry in the Bible that allows them to do so. But right. We have to think very logically. I mean, you go out to war. This is an enemy. You know, this is life or death, and you're going to start dealing with, you know, it's Shabbat today, and we're not going to fight.
Mm.
So I think what happened in the Hasmonean period was they just completely forgot that you're allowed to do it.
Mm. Yeah. Okay.
Maybe. It's interesting.
It's a very good question. Something to consider.
The history of Halakha is actually pretty tricky, how it developed.
Sure. So let me go to verse 26, because this is particularly interesting, and it doesn't go into great detail in regards to this, and maybe you've got something more to offer, I'd be interested. Then Joshua charged them at that time, saying, cursed be the man before Yehovah who rises up and builds this city, Jericho. He shall lay its foundations with his firstborn, and with his youngest he shall set up its gates. Now, if we go to, what is it, First Kings
chapter 22 or something, it says that Yechiel Beit Ha'eli, Yechiel of the city of Beit El,
mm-hmm.
or Bethel, builds the city.
He does.
And the curse happens. Here's something interesting. Is again, the archaeology. The city was rebuilt. Yes, it was rebuilt once. Before that rebuilding, the housing, people who live in the area lived only around the city itself. They wouldn't build inside. They wouldn't live in the city itself. They only mm-hmm. built around it.
So it became.
They left it.
There were peripheral sort of satellite towns around the city rather than rebuilding the actual city.
Exactly. No one wanted to live inside the city.
Sure.
So people actually were afraid of the curse.
Well, this is the thing. I don't really understand it, and maybe you can offer more information in the Hebrew. I don't know, but we're in 1 Kings chapter 16, verse 34, and it says...
Oh, it's chapter 16. You sure about that?
Yeah, 16:34. It says, in his days...
I just found it. Yeah, you're right.
Hiel of Bethel built Jericho. Now, what does this mean? I don't get it. He laid its foundations with Abiram, his firstborn, and with his youngest son, Segub.
See, he has a funny name, Segub or something like that.
Segub. He set up its gates according to the word of Yehovah, which he had spoken through Yehoshua bin Nun. So what does it mean that, you know, he laid its foundations with his firstborn? What does that mean?
Well, look at Joshua chapter 6, verse 21. It says, and Joshua, he vayashba, it means he made an oath, but it's an oath to force other people.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, just saying, cursed is the man before Hashem who will stand up and build the city of Jericho. Mm-hmm. With his firstborn, he'll put the foundations, and his youngest one, he'll put the doors up. It's a repeat of what happened in Joshua.
It is, but what does it mean? What does it mean with his firstborn and with his youngest? Does it mean he's going to
when he starts putting, when he puts down the foundation, his firstborn is going to die, and throughout that time, he's going to some of the rest of the sons are going to die. Mm-hmm. And then the when he puts up the doors of the city, the last thing he usually put in the house is the doors. Today, it's not like that. Usually when they build a house, the doors at one point are put up before they even finish the house.
Sure.
But basically you're saying when they put up the doors, which is the finishing off, mm-hmm. the final touches you have to put on the city, the last child will die.
And so that implication is fairly obvious in the Hebrew, right?
Yeah, it's pretty obvious here. Basically, the curse is you start, the first son dies, everyone dies in the middle, and then the youngest one will die when you finish the city.
And so it happens.
Now, there's another interesting thing. So when the city was rebuilt again a couple of hundred years later, and when they were excavating, they discovered a body of a woman with a severed head.
Doi!
And there's a lot of speculation exactly why she was there. I actually recently read, and I read this a couple of times in different books. It's kind of funny. But I think that all the books were dependent on one another.
Mm-hmm.
And they said this might have been his wife. It's completely theoretical. We don't know if it's true.
Mm-hmm.
But if someone came up with this theory that this is Hiel's wife, and she saw her, she knew of the curse, and in protest, she moved and she tried to stop the workers with her own body. She tried to disrupt the work, and probably someone killed her.
Oy.
There was probably a fight or something, and someone just chopped her head off.
And that's the speculation.
And that's one of the speculations I've seen. There's different ideas. Maybe just someone died, but someone strongly suggested this might have been his wife, because it's a woman. They were able to identify as being a woman,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was just weird. They're going to suddenly find a body of a woman. Like, what is this?
And a creepy.
So it's a theory I just read. I read a couple of times. I just saw it recently again surface up in another book that I'm reading.
Okay.
It might have been his wife, and she just protested. She moved into the city, sat there, and tried to stop them from working.
Hmm.
So someone just said, okay, you're not going to disrupt us, and just killed her.
And so, and look, you know, the next verse, it says, so Yehovah was with Yehoshua, and his fame spread throughout all the country. Now, is this the fame of Yehoshua, or is it the fame of Yehovah?
Well, so obviously, when the person who represents God is famous, then God is famous again. You know, it's when the people of Israel go up and up, and the nations go, okay, the God of Israel is with his people and he's a powerful God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but there's a big mistake in the world that they didn't understand that also the God can punish, and the fulfillment of the punishment is also showing that God is keeping his eye open on his people. Mm-hmm. The fact that the Jewish people, the Israelites, have been suffering for the past 2,000 years is not just, it's not punishment in this essence of like, you betrayed something, then you're going to be punished, and it's just God's wrath pouring on the people of Israel,
mm-hmm.
you know, and he's forsaken his people. No, it's actually fulfillment of what the Torah says.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end he says, oh, when they bring them back, then they're going to be fine.
Amen.
You know, so it's completely, it's a concept that even the punishment shows the glory of God.
Amen.
And it's something which is very, very, very strange to a lot of people, and it actually completely debunks the whole idea of replacement theology, by the way. Just completely debunks it.
Sure.
Because the Bible clearly states, when you transgress against me, I will punish you. And that happens.
Yes, yes, and it does. And so this particular curse also would have become legendary, I suppose. I think it's very fair to say that, and therefore it's not far-fetched to say that Hiel's wife would have known, and she would have been in fear of her son's lives, quite rightly. So, you know, I mean, maybe it's not so far-fetched. But in any case, chapter 7, Yoel, what happens in chapter 7?
Ooh, big mess.
Big mess.
Big, big mess. Someone makes, I'm going to jokingly call it a big boo-boo.
Okay. It was a huge boo-boo. And it cost it cost the lives of 36 men.
Yeah. Exactly. It actually says kiss is Shloshim Shishan Nashim. So it's approximately 36 men.
Okay.
And it shows there's an interesting thing going on here. So first of all, we have this man from the tribe of Judah,
mm-hmm.
who, while during the battle, I mean, everyone went in. Anyone who was able to fight, which is basically men from the age of 20 to the age of 60, went in.
Mm-hmm.
And no, while during the battle, he finds this nice stash of pretty expensive stuff,
mm-hmm.
and he covets it, and he takes it with him, and he doesn't say anything. He doesn't tell anyone, and he keeps it a secret because he knows he's not supposed to do it. But he says, maybe I'll be able to, get it through, and no one's going to notice.
Mm.
And God makes a point here.
He does, because they...
He makes a very big point.
While he takes it and he hides it, he stashes it under his tent, The men go into battle against, now how do I pronounce, is this Ai?
Ai, yes, Ai. It's the city of Ai.
The city of Ai, and Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai, which is beside Beth Aven on the east side of Bethel, and spoke to them saying, go up and spy out their country. And so they went up, and they came back, and they went, you know, we don't need that many. Let the men rest. You know, we need maybe 2,000 or 3,000. There's not that many in the city. We can do this. This is a small thing, right? And so they went, and he sent about 2,000 or 3,000 men. And
as you know, he actually sends 3,000 men.
He sends 3,000 men,
He
picks the highest number. That's right. Yeah. So about verse 4. So about 3,000 men went up from the people, but they fled before the men of Ai, and the men of Ai struck down about 36 men, for they chased them from before the gate as far as Shebarim.
So I'm not too sure if that's actually the name of a place, because it's HaShevarim, the Shevarim. So I'm not too sure if it's actually the name of a place. I mean, let me look at that for a second.
Sure.
It might be just ruins of some place as well. You never know. Shevarim.
Shevarim. So what does it mean? What does Shevarim mean? It's a plural, right? What is it?
So the word Shevel is a break or something.
Uh-huh.
So they're actually saying it's a description of a place, and it says it might have been a place, a very rocky area, looks as if the mountain's broken up, or a place with pits, many, many pits.
Ah, okay. Okay.
Some say it's the name of a place. There's a different opinion to you.
Okay, so but they struck them down from the gates to that point, and it says, therefore the hearts of the people melted and became like water. So they were basically, I guess, they were crushed. They felt absolutely devastated. Joshua tore his clothes and fell to the earth, right? Put dust on his head, yeah, and really mournful.
And there's a point here. We just had this glorious battle, miracles. We go to the next city and we fall like this?
Yeah, because they're unaware. Everyone's like, they're unaware.
What? And so it was surprising, and when I was reading this, it was surprising. Like, okay, this happens. Think for a second. And no one does that. No one thinks, okay, we just had a miraculous war. I told everyone not to touch anything there, and now we lose. Someone sinned. No one does that.
Mm.
Everyone just goes into this panic of like, we just lost a war, we just lost a battle, you know.
Mm.
No one stops to think. So God like turns around to Joshua and says to him, why are you crying out to me?
Yeah, and he does.
It kind of reminds what happened at the sea. God says to him, why do you cry out to me? Tell the people to travel.
Yeah.
Same thing here. God turns around to him and says to Joshua, I said something earlier on.
That's right.
I think you have to stop to think. It struck me suddenly. It's like, they don't think for a moment. They don't stop to think. And then God says to him, okay, someone has sinned, someone's stolen, someone has taken from the cherem. And then he turns around and he says, okay, we have to check who it is. Now, no one knows who it is.
Now, this is interesting. Before you go on, this is verse 11. Israel has sinned, and they have also transgressed my covenant, which I commanded them, for they have even taken some of the accursed things and have both stolen and deceived. Why are there... I mean, let me just go through.
There's
it again.
There's a lot of ands here.
There's a lot of ands. They've sinned. They've transgressed. It's emphasized, and they have taken some of the accursed things and stolen and deceived.
Let me talk.
Go ahead.
No, it's basically expressing the anger. It's expressing that there's a wrath here, and this is why it's so emphasized. It's emphatic. It's like saying they did this and that and that and this and that. Think of it as like you know, when someone's very angry, they just say everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they emphasize everything. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. God's kind of like going like, you know, I'm angry here. This is we had an agreement here. We actually have. He calls it a covenant.
Mm-hmm.
It says vegam avoid briti. They have transgressed against my covenant. It's like this is pretty. When he says the word covenant, this is a lot more serious.
Mm-hmm.
This is not. When the moment that someone uses the word covenant, is like we have a pact. You have to be very, very careful what you do. So it's actually expressing the anger, the wrath, and it shows that God is angry here, and therefore this is why people died. Now this [S2] Right. [S1] Is the second battle. Think of what it does to people morally. They go in glorious fight, and suddenly they lose.
Mm.
You know, this verse really, you know, when you take, for example, descriptions with Moses, for example, there's never a description so emphatic. You know, God says, they've sinned against me, they transgressed against me. Here it's like and. You know, God's basically saying, I just did something that no nation, it's never been done to any nation. You just crossed the river. You went into a city. You barely even had to fight because the walls fell over. And if someone was stupid enough to do this, I mean, it's infuriating. Mm. You know, it's
So he's infuriated, and therefore there is the emphasis, and it goes on to say, and he says, and they have also put it among their own stuff. Therefore, the children of Israel could not stand before their enemies, but they turned their backs before their enemies because they have become doomed to instruction and destruction, and that's what we were talking about earlier on. Neither will I be with you anymore unless you destroy the accursed from among you. Get up, sanctify the people, and say, sanctify yourselves for tomorrow, because thus says Yehovah Elohim of Israel, there is an accursed thing in your midst, O Israel. You cannot stand before your enemies until you take away the accursed thing from among you. Now, is it fair? Is it fair to, I mean, listen, you served in the army, right?
Yeah, for a while. By the way, it uses the word cherem here again. They have taken from the cherem.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if accursed thing is a good translation.
Okay.
You know, it's the things that we're not supposed to touch. It's not cursed. Or it is kind of cursed if you're not the right person.
The thing that is banned, the thing that is under a ban, might be more appropriate. And so, I mean, I'm just asking, like, you know, you were in the army. Like, does it ever cross your mind, you know, that the state of Israel is in at the moment, can we expect God to fight on our behalf when there is so much about Israel that is counter Torah? I mean, he says, listen, he says, you cannot stand before your enemies until you take away the things that I have banned from among you.
So I'm just looking at the lexicon, and I'm fed up with trying to play around with the word cherem. So the word cherem is devoted thing or banned from usage for regular people, mm-hmm. consecrated, I mean, basically holy to God. It's not just, doesn't mean cursed. I mean, there can be a curse on it, because if you touch it, you're the wrong person to deal with it. But in general, it doesn't mean curse it. So let's put it this. First of all, one of the funny things I've heard is that they say that the Israeli tactics are not that good, and for some reason it works.
Right.
I heard from this guy who served in the American army. He said they used to tell us that he said to me that they used to tell him that, you know, never learn battle tactics from the Israelis, because what they do is completely insane and usually doesn't work. So there is a level here that we do see things which are not normal,
mm-hmm.
things that, and I think that here we go into the issue that God says, I'm doing for my namesake.
Right.
And God is basically going, okay, you're messing things up again, but this time it's for my namesake. I'll deal with it, but I want you here.
So read for me verse 9 of chapter 7. Give it to me in Hebrew and then explain it to the audience.
Okay, so it says, וישמעו הכנעני וכל יושבי הארץ ונסבו עלינו והכריתו את שמנו מן הארץ ומה תעשה לשמך הגדול. So it says, and the Canaanites will hear and all the residents of the land, and they will circle us and cut our name off from the land, what you do for your namesake, or for your great name.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, you know, when Israel is around, so God's name is also known.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the Jews would have not survived, the Christian world would have never known the name of God. They would always call him Domini or something,
because
mm-hmm. the Catholic Church would have never collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
And really, you know, by it says, and they will know that your name is upon us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so us being around is also God's name basically being around as well.
Because hasn't it been that the enemies of Israel have always attempted to surround them and cut them off and cut off our name from the earth? Then and Joshua asks, he says, then what will you do for your great name? And so, I have to agree. I think you're right that he is merciful, and that Israel continues to this day, and the Jewish people continue to this day because of his great name. Because of his great name, he does these things.
He has a plan, and he's going to do it. And no matter what anyone tries to do, they're not going to get rid of us.
Amen.
We will never vanish.
Amen.
It will not work.
Amen. So in the morning, therefore, you shall be brought according to your tribes. Now he brings the tribes, and he says, and Yehovah will choose among the tribes, and then choose among the families, choose among the households. And then it says, then it shall be that he who has taken the accursed thing shall be, now again, this is hard, he shall be burned with fire, and he and all that he has, because he has transgressed the covenant of Yehovah, because he has done a disgraceful thing in Israel. So lo and behold, that's what happens, right? Let us know what goes on next.
So they do what's called a lot. Now, there's different ways of doing it. They might have done it with the Urim and Thummim, or the Urim and Thummim,
mm-hmm.
as some people might call it, which was basically using the breastplate, asking for things.
Sure.
Or they had other ways. For example, you know, Maybe they wrote down the names, put it in a box, and start pulling out the names.
Sure.
But there's different ways. It says Vayilached. So there's a few cases where we have this as well. For example, with King Saul, we have something very similar. King Saul, after a battle with the Philistines, tells everyone not to eat. This is in the first book of Samuel. Tells them not to eat. And then Jonathan comes by and he says, okay, I'm hungry. There's honey in the field.
Yeah.
He takes his staff. He eats from the honey from the edge of his staff. And everyone starts eating. And he wants to know who did it. So he said, everyone stand there. They know who did it. They're not saying anything. Mm-hmm. So they do some kind of a lot there as well. So there might have been different ways of doing it. I mean, here they have the high priest and everything. So maybe they did it with the breastplate. Maybe they did it with some other method. Mm-hmm. But basically, what they do is first of all, we have to find what tribe it is. It's like as if there's like a count there. It doesn't just give you a name. The heads of tribes might have walked by and then something glowed. I don't know. And they say, sure. Okay, it's him.
Sure.
And then they pass the families through until they narrow it down to this individual called Achan. It's an interesting game with his name, Achan, because the name Achan sounds like the word Achar, which Achan is with a nun in the end, with an N in the end, and Achar is very, very similar, almost the exact same consonants, just it has a resh in the end. So they decide to execute him. Now, classic execution in the Bible is usually stoning. Mm-hmm. There's a few cases where they burn. Here they decide to burn. I'm not too sure why. Some commentators say that, yes, this is something unusual. They said they decide to burn him.
But it's not just him. Right? I mean, it gets even more serious than that.
There's a bit of a discussion, exactly. Some people claim it wasn't, but it actually says in verse 24, so that Joshua took Achan, son of Zerah, and the silver, and the aderet, which is like an overcoat or something, and the tongue of gold. They had like a little piece of gold. It looked like a tongue, but it's a lick of gold or something.
Yeah.
And his sons and his daughters and ox and his donkeys and his cat, everything he has, and his tent, everything he has in Israel with him, and they went out to a place called Emek Achor. They named it Emek Achor, which is very similar to the word Achar, which is very similar to the name Achan. So I have my doubts if this is his real name.
Okay.
It might have not been his real name, but there's a whole word game here with his name and the name of the place and what he did, and this is why they call it Emek Achor, which is similar to the word Achar, which is the verbal, which means to put a shame or disgrace on Israel.
Yeah.
Don't take an exact translation here because I'm not working on that at the moment.
So,
and they go up, and he says to him, "You've done the Achira from Israel, and therefore God will do it to you as well." And they stone him, he and all the children of Israel, and they burn him. It's kind of interesting. They stone him, they burn him, and then they cover him with stone him again.
You know, I was relieved. I was relieved that they stoned him first and they didn't burn him alive. They stoned him, obviously, they would have at least finished him off there in stoning him, and then they burnt him and probably all of his possessions as well. And it would suggest, it kind of reads in the English at least, that they did burn his sons and his daughters. His oxen, his donkeys, his sheep, his tent, and all of that he had.
So some people say they did, some people they didn't. I mean, I think it's quite, you know, why did they take everyone with them if they're not going to do it to everyone? Because also the members of the family probably knew what happened. So they're making an example of him.
Mm. Yeah. And don't they make it? I mean, this is one huge example because it costs the lives of about 36 people and everyone's going, what's going on? And all of a sudden, there's this big finale of, you know, we narrow it down to here, we narrow it down to here, we narrow it down to the household, we narrow it down to the individual. And then Joshua says to him, he says, my son, I beg you, give glory to the Lord God of Israel and make confession to him and tell me now what you have done and do not hide it from me. And so he does. He comes clean and he tells him everything. And I just want to ask you about verse 21 because it says, and when I saw among the spoils a beautiful Babylonian garment. Is that what you have in the Hebrew?
It says Aderet Shenar. So Shenar was another name for Babylon, yeah.
Okay.
It wasn't called Babel yet. It was called the Valley of Shenar. So it was kind of like a very, very expensive overcoat or garment of sorts.
And so he grabs that. He grabs 200 shekels of silver and a tongue of gold weighing 50 shekels. He coveted them. He hid them. And lo and behold, all is known now. And he has been, he and all that is his has been utterly destroyed. And what an example has been made. And if that doesn't instill the fear of the Lord into Israel, what will?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm. So they create a huge pile of rocks upon him. So every time people walk by, they go, this is where Achan was executed. for doing what he did. Mm. There's a whole point here. It's like an example of like when a new boss walks into a job, he tries to show that he's the big boss there. Mm-hmm. So he makes a lot of noise and everything. Basically, he's trying to strike the fear of the workers. He can be their friend, he can be their very good buddy, but they also have to remember that he's a new boss. Mm-hmm. Same thing here. God said, okay, now that we're done with the desert, we're entering the land, we're in the covenant itself. Okay, here's a point. You play with the covenant, this is what's going to happen.
This is what's going to happen, yeah.
So it doesn't say that God pushed him to do it, but I think that essentially does make the point.
It really does.
This is why it's so big and put a few tall rocks upon him just to make sure that there's a huge burial site.
And so it serves as a monument of his sin and the wrath and judgment of Yehovah, and it serves as I say, a monument to the fear, to remind the people to reverentially fear God. And so we go into chapter 8 because we still have to deal with.
And what's very important here with the eye is that there's no miracles in this case.
True.
There's tactical maneuvers. So it means that God's still not very happy with what happened. He said, you're going to have to take care of this one by yourself.
You're going to have to work a little harder for this one.
Yeah, but they use a tactic here.
It's not just that. Yeah, there is tactics, and you're going to have to work for this one. I'm not going to pull any strings for you guys, but I'm going to tell you what to do. And it's spoil and it's cattle you shall take now. And so this is interesting that now, as they weren't allowed for Jericho, they are allowed to take its spoil and its cattle.
Because Jericho, there was a point with Jericho. Now it's like, okay, now it's just a war. Now we're just going out to war. There's spoils of war. I mean, today, by the way, spoils of war today in military is illegal. You can't take anything. Uh-huh. I remember there was actually a case of a soldier did take something from they raided some terrorist center, which was part of the Palestinian Authority, but it was they had terrorists going out from there. Mm-hmm. And some brilliant soldier decided to take something from one of the officers. He sent in prison for a while.
You're kidding.
They do not like that in the Israeli army. Officers, and it doesn't matter who you are, you take something, that's it. And there was one case he took some like a sword or something from an office. They had a mountain on the wall, an Arabian sword. He took it with him, and he just walked out with it, and he put it in the van, and they drove away, and he took it with him, and someone saw it, and he was reported, and he was arrested. They actually arrested him on the base and took him to trial, and he sat into prison for a while because they don't accept this stuff. We don't steal. Mm. End of story.
Is it stealing?
It's considered to be it's actually a war crime if you do that.
Okay. But back then it was all fair game in war. And
back,
so
back then, yeah. This is how soldiers got their pay for what they did.
Sure.
You know?
Sure. And so their previous defeat served to lay the ambush, right?
Mm-hmm. So they changed the whole thing. They made it look as if they're repeating the same mistake, but now they're playing a game here. Mm-hmm. So they advanced towards the city, and they hired a whole bunch of people, whole group of soldiers, like thousands of soldiers, hired on the other side. And they advanced towards the city, and then they go out, and they at one point they turn around and start running away. Mm-hmm. So they're saying, oh, they're running away again from the same way they ran away in the beginning. While they're chasing them, they're leaving the city open, which is kind of silly. They leave the city open. So while they're running away and they're getting them far, far away from the city, the other group goes in and takes over the city. And at one point when they start burning the city, the smoke goes up. They turn around, someone like looks back and goes, oh, wait, this smoke, fire. And when they're done with the city, they basically do a claw where they basically advance from all ends, shutting them down into one place and basically slowly killing them.
Mm.
It's called the Melchatzaim in Hebrew, or it's called Tzvat, actually. It's called the Shitat Tzvat. It's a method of a claw where you just basically now close down on the enemy.
Right. And I believe I read somewhere that they killed about 12,000, the inhabitants of Ai, but they took the king of Ai, they took him alive and brought him to Joshua. What's the purpose of that, do you think?
So usually when no one kills the king, only a king is allowed to king. It's one of the rules of war engagement. And it's very rare that anyone did something different than that.
Mm-hmm.
So if the king gets killed, and they usually bring the head to the victorious king.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I know it's a bit gruesome, but this is how it was done. They didn't have humanitarian, no UN and stuff like that then. And not that the UN is any good, by the way.
I was going to say it's just as well, really.
Yeah, it's just as well. I mean, the UN, I mean, what they did, for example, we did in Bosnia is horrendous. You know, we're an army of peace. This is where we killed a whole bunch of people in Bosnia, Herzegovina, and whatnot. Again, when the UN gets involved, it causes a lot of trouble. But it's usually the practice was that the losing king has to be brought, if he's still alive, is brought before the winning king. Mm-hmm. In this case, it's Joshua. And they usually execute them. Now, he actually burns the city and turns it into an eternal pile. Mm-hmm. And he hangs the king on a tree. And he hangs him on a tree. And then towards the evening, he takes him down. Mm-hmm. And he's fulfilling a commandment which appears in things
like Deuteronomy 24 or 25. I'm just looking for it now.
And it actually says that if you execute someone and hang them on a tree, you may not leave them on the tree until the evening. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting, the whole thing. Why are they hanging him on a tree? What's the point? It's basically symbolic. You put him up and you say, okay, this is what happens to the ones that, you know, transgress against God. In this case, fight the people of Israel. But it's fascinating because it says there that when you execute someone, and it's an execution of the people of Israel, someone who transgressed against the Torah, you hang them and then you take them down before the evening. Mm-hmm. Here he's hung up, he's strung up, and they still practice the same thing.
That's right.
Still practice of taking him down and actually burying him.
And there it is. It's Deuteronomy chapter 21, verse 22. If a man has committed a sin deserving of death and he is put to death and you hang him on a tree, his body shall not remain overnight on the tree. You shall surely bury him that day so that you do not defile the land which Yehovah your Elohim is giving you as an inheritance, for he who is hanged is accursed of God.
Exactly. So leaving a body, again, there's an issue here of respect to the dead and stuff like that.
Mm.
And it's a question, what does it mean, the kirelat Elohim talui? There's a whole array of opinions what that means. You know, it's the curses of God. There's different ways of explaining what kirelat Elohim talui means. There's a lot of opinions, and I've never figured this one out. So if anyone has any idea, please post it.
Yeah, put it in the comments section. We'd be interested in reading that.
Yeah, because it's not clear. What is this whole thing? A body's hanging on the tree. It's a cursed. Mm. So I think part of it is also the uncleanness of the body, and it's when you want to do something, defile something, then you leave a body outside, let it rot. I mean, again, it can be different things. I am not sure. I have to be very blunt. I have no idea.
So before we conclude this section, though, I want to ask you one more thing, because it says in verse 26, for Joshua did not draw back his hand with which he stretched out the spear until he had utterly destroyed all the inhabitants of Ai. Now that brings us back to last week when we discussed some of the parallels between Joshua and Moses and the potential fulfillment of Deuteronomy 18 verse 5, I think it is. There's another
Moses,
similarity.
Yes, the whole thing of holding the staff. So he is actually holding a spear because he represents war. He's different. He's not Moses with a staff. He is a general, a leader, a king with a spear. He's basically the representative of war.
Mm-hmm.
Moses was a representative of giving the law, giving of the Torah.
Yes.
And Joshua is a representative of the wars of God. So Moses is the law of God. Joshua is the war of God.
Yes.
And
that's an excellent point.
That's a difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's the difference. That's one of the differences in between them. But on the other hand, there's also similar things. He's holding Noteba Kidon. He's holding the staff stretched out towards the city, and it's very similar to when they crossed the ocean here, when they crossed the Dead Sea, that he put the staff up. When they fought against the Amalekites, he lifted his hands up, and his hands were up until they were done with the war. So there are similarities here as well.
Mm. So that's Exodus chapter 17, and it explains those parallels there. So I think we've covered everything we wanted to cover. Now, the remainder of this chapter 8, what I'm going to do for the listeners is post the link to the discussion that Yoel and I had in regards to your recent visit, I guess, well, was it, I don't know, 6 months ago, almost 5 months?
Four months ago.
4 or 5 months ago. And so this is in regards to the visiting of Joshua's altar, which was just a fascinating interview, and it deals specifically with this passage here from verse 30 to the end of chapter 8. in verse 35. And so the week after that, we're going to pick up from chapter 9, right?
Yeah, we'll pick up from chapter 9. And by the way, I just want to point out that we, Book of Joshua, we're not going to do the whole Book of Joshua, because there's also a lot of chapters here that go in description of places in the land. And it's not going to be something that we're going to be dealing with, because we're not here to teach geography.
Right.
So we're not going to do the whole Book of Joshua. There's going to be a whole bunch of stuff we're going to skip.
We like the stories.
This series of books is mostly stories. I mean, sure. There's prophecies here and there, but there were individual prophecies for the storyline. So
sure, absolutely.
So we're going to do as much as we can. We're going to try to pull out as much as we can from the Book of Joshua.
Mm-hmm. And we'll move on from there. We'll highlight the stories and the prophecies and the light of the prophets with Yoel ben Shlomo, my friend. Thank you for coming back onto Truth to You. And just a reminder, everybody, that Hebrew in Israel is the Facebook page. You should go there. You should like it. You should engage with some of the information that Yoel makes freely available there. And also, if you would like quality Hebrew lessons from this very knowledgeable man, you can inquire in regards to those by emailing at hebrewinisrael@gmail.com. That's hebrewinisrael@gmail.com. So until next week, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's Word. Shalom.